Well, I am jacked because today we get to talk about Santa. Yes, you heard me right. We are talking about Santa Claus. My name is Jared Kieber. This is the PGPC podcast. We're glad to have you with us. As always, you can check out our website, PrinceGeorgePentecostalChurch.com, and we would love to hear from you. You can drop us a line. Check out the sermons link, and under the sermons link, there is a series called Podcast, and there's a form you can fill out on there. This will be the last episode until the new year. So enjoy it, and we will see you back in a couple of weeks once this is done. But let's jump in. Santa, Christmas, all of those things. December is a fun time of year because the entirety of our culture seems to buy into this idea of Christmas. And there's a whole whack of things that go on along with that because you've got kind of a Christian holiday, I guess you could call it, in one sense. You've also got kind of a pagan synchronization of that holiday, and then you've just got the capitalistic, commercialized aspect of it where you buy people gifts, families get together, you get time off of work generally, or you get paid a lot more if you're working. Like, there's all of these things going on in our culture that just make this time of year a very distinct time of year. One of the things that we always do is we go as a family and we watch, over the past number of years, we go to this place called Candy Cane Lane, and there's this light show that you go around every house. Most houses anyways are decorated, and it's just a very distinct time of year. There's the snow, there is, you know, the eggnog lattes that so many people rave about from Starbucks. Not huge on the eggnog lattes myself, but that's okay. So what do we do with this Christian, kind of pagan, kind of commercialized holiday? Well, if I had a really simple answer for you, this would be a short podcast, but I do have some thoughts on this from a Christian perspective. And so there's a few things that I want to touch on, and hopefully you will learn some things, maybe be encouraged in some things. I don't know. Let's see where it goes. So Santa Claus. Santa is an interesting figure because historically he is based off of Saint Nicholas. And if you know anything about Saint Nicholas, you're actually doing a bit better than I am, because it seems that Saint Nicholas is actually a fairly obscure historical figure. So there is a legend regarding Saint Nicholas that he was at what we call the Council of Nicaea, or the Nicene Council. Now, if you know anything about church history, very, very important council, because in 325, the church leaders got together. That's 325 AD. Church leaders got together and they discussed controversy specifically around the teachings of a guy named Arius. Now, Arius taught that Jesus was a created creature by the Father. So the Arians kind of had this chant that would go something like this: there was a time when the Son was not. Now, you may ask, well, why is that important? It's important because the Bible teaches the opposite of that. It teaches that Jesus is God, truly God, and therefore there is not a time when Jesus was not. Jesus has always been alongside of the Father. That's part of the Christian doctrine we call the Trinity. There is one God, eternally existent, in three persons: the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. So Arius, of course, taught that that wasn't the case. There were people who agreed with him, but by and large, the church came together and said, no, we don't believe that. The Bible does not teach that. A great place to go would be the book of John. John 1:1 expressly says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, what you'll have is today, we actually still have people who buy into Arius's teachings. Specifically, you've got the Jehovah's Witnesses or the Mormons, and they would say, well, if you go to John 1:1, it says that Jesus was a God, but he wasn't God the same way that the Father was God. The problem with that is, if you know anything about Greek at all, and I don't know a ton, but I do know a little bit, a more direct translation of John 1:1 is, in the beginning, or in beginning was the Word was with the Word was the God. So it's what we call difference between a direct and an indirect object, and we don't need to go into the English lesson for that. I found that when I started learning a little bit of Greek, I realized how little I knew about English and had to kind of relearn some of the basic English tools. But at the end of the day, you've got this guy Arius who's teaching Jesus was created. The church fathers are saying no. And now you're saying, why does any of that matter specifically when it comes to this guy, Saint Nicholas? Well, there is a legend regarding Saint Nicholas that he was at the Council of Nicaea and he slapped Arius. So you've got Santa Claus slapping a heretic, which is kind of this urban legend that people love. Because, I mean, who doesn't love the idea of Santa Claus slapping someone, especially a false teacher? The problem with that is the historical evidence is somewhat lacking. And so you don't see until, I believe it's around 500 AD, so about 200 years after the Council of Nicaea, this story start to form. And it's actually probably even later than that. It started as St. Nicholas was there, but he slapped an Arian, and then it morphed, like all good urban legends do, into he slapped Arius himself. And so you've got this morphing urban legend of, you know, St. Nicholas, who was the heretic slapper. But the historical evidence is actually very weak that that was the case. And we don't actually know all that much, it would seem to me, from my research about St. Nicholas. But of course, St. Nicholas morphed into our urban legend of Santa Claus. And if you know anything about Christmas, which I'm assuming you probably know a bit, the idea is that, of course, this Santa Claus gives gifts, and you could go from there. There is a website, I believe, dedicated to St. Nicholas, and there are some historic facts on there. But now we have Santa Claus. And so a big question that I think a lot of parents wrestle with, I wrestle with this, my wife and I know some of our friends do, is what do we do with the idea of Santa Claus? I've got a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and my wife and I, and you don't have to go this way, of course, but my wife and I decided we're not going to do Santa Claus, strictly for the reason that, be careful how I say this, because I don't want to put anybody in a I'm not trying to create conflict here, I guess is the way that I'd say this. We decided that it was good for us to teach our kids that Santa Claus is based off of a historical figure, but he's not someone who actually comes and does what the guy in the red suit does. Ironically, and this is really funny, my dad kind of looks like Santa Claus. He's got kind of a jolly, he's lost a lot of weight recently. Kudos to my dad. He's done a really good job on that. But he has this jolly belly, and when he grows his beard out, it is white, like a big white beard. The last town that they lived in, my dad tells a story of a kid kind of poking at his mom and then pointing at my dad saying, "Mom, it's Santa." And he really does kind of look like Santa Claus. And so we've got this whole thing going on with our family. But my wife and I have decided that we aren't going to do Santa Claus with our kids, because we just, there are a number of reasons for that. And I don't want to make you feel guilty necessarily for the decision that you do or don't make. But that's actually been an interesting journey, because our girls watch TV, and of course Santa makes a number of appearances in pop culture and on TV, on Paw Patrol, on Frosty the Snowman, on all sorts of TV shows. And so my 4-year-old is like, "No, Santa's real." And we're like, "Sweetie, we don't actually buy that. We don't think that Santa's real. In fact, he's not. It's just kind of a legend that's been made up." And of course, as a 4-year-old, she's like, "No, you guys are wrong. Santa's legit." And so we're working through that, and we're okay with the fact that we're working through that. But it is kind of this interesting historical development that's turned into an urban legend that Christian parents especially are like, "What do we even do with Santa Claus?" I think the critique that I would have, and you don't have to have this, but is that if you are saying, "Man, Santa is real," and then there comes a point as a Christian parent where you have to say to your kids, "No, Santa isn't real," they're sitting there going, "Okay, well, what else isn't real? Oh, the Easter Bunny isn't real. Okay, the Tooth Fairy isn't real. Okay, I can't see any of those things, and they've turned out to be not real. What do we do with God, because I can't see him? Is he still real?" And so we've kind of set that as the tension that's helped us make the decision in that. Again, that's not to judge you if you do Santa Claus with your kids. Let's just say that's where we've fallen. And so it's important to wrestle with this. But again, we see this tension around the idea of this Christian holiday that's kind of not a Christian holiday, that's a cultural thing, and what do we do with it? And that's where we begin to talk about the next aspect, is what do we even do with the holiday itself as Christians? What do we do with it? Well, I think first and foremost, and I look at this with a few other holidays as well, is that Christianity does have an aspect of redemption to it. Of course, when I talk redemption, that's based all the way back out of the Old Testament narrative of God's people, that God redeems his people out of sin and slavery. And we won't unpack that too much. One of my favorite things to unpack, but there's this idea of redemption. And what, if anything, can be redeemed in this holiday that's kind of almost in if you Google it or YouTube it, this is another area where the conspiracy theorists will come out, or kind of the people who hang around conspiracy theories on Christianity and the pagan holidays and kind of all of this stuff. But is there a redeemable aspect of Christmas for Christianities? And I think there absolutely 100%, 110% is, because in a sense, our culture at this time of year looks to the remembrance of Jesus, even if it's loosely, and there's something that we can do with that, and we'll talk about that more later, but we can begin to redeem some of the aspects of culture. So I'll explain what I mean by that. The giving of gifts, for example. Now, we live in a really, really affluent culture. Even those of us who are somewhat poor, we have a lot. And so a funny story, we're driving yesterday morning, I think it was, and my four-year-old again, who were coming up on Christmas, she loves the idea of Christmas, says to my wife and I, she says, you know, I've got a lot of toys already. Is it, of course, a paraphrase, but she's like, I've got a lot of toys already, but if you need to buy me more for Christmas, you can. And that's kind of where we have this conversation where it's like, yeah, you do have a lot. Like, if you look in our toy room, there's a lot of stuff going on there. So what do we do with our kids in the midst of this affluence, in balancing almost our cultural greed along with the joy of giving and receiving? And so I think there's a tension there. But the redemption aspect of that in me says, man, how good is it to give? Okay, and does that not have the ability for us to say, in my giving, I am experiencing what God has experienced in giving to us, imperfectly, of course. But there's some sense of, can we glorify God in that aspect of giving, in that aspect of charity? I think we can. And there's a picture of the way that God may feel, again, imperfectly, and there are tensions here, but there's a picture of God giving. And in receiving, man, when I open a gift and I get something good, can that point me to Jesus and saying, God, this gift is really good, and I enjoy that my wife or my kids or my parents or my friend went out and had all this thought put into this, and it stirs in me a sense of joy. Help me to understand that there's so much better gift in Jesus who is given to me freely. And so I've kind of wrestled with that over the years, but I think that there are some redeemable aspects. I think there's a tension that also has to be held there, that Christmas is largely commercialized. Like, that's just a reality. Just a reality that we have to live with. But I do think that there are redeemable things in Christmas. But that brings me to the tension, and that's this, that we do have to be careful with synchronization. And the idea of synchronization is that we begin to meld things together. Specifically, synchronization is usually a melding of religions. So I think back a number of years ago, my wife and I had the opportunity to travel to India. In India, one of the issues the global workers that we were working with said is that people will add Jesus to the rest of the religions or to their kind of, what's the word I'm looking for, pantheon. And so you have the area that we were in was primarily Hindu. So you have people who would serve a lot of gods, and Jesus would just be added as one more. It's kind of this synchronization of the gospel and Christianity into the religious context that already exists. And synchronization, if you read the Bible and if you listen to what Jesus says, doesn't work, because Jesus says there is no way except for me. He's kind of exclusive that way, which a lot of people don't like, but that's just the reality. And so when it comes to Christmas, there's this tension of, there's the redeemable aspects of what's become a cultural phenomenon, essentially, and there's also the danger of synchronization that we face, and I think we have to wrestle with that. I'm not going to suggest to you that I have answered that question perfectly. I think the biggest thing for me is that I have leaned into the part of Christmas that says we are going to remember and celebrate Jesus coming, what we call the incarnation. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But there's also this aspect of, I think it is okay to have a cultural holiday and to enjoy it. I try to be careful not to mix those things together too much. And I think as Christians, a lot of us mix those things together quite a lot. And that's not to say that there's not value in some of those things. I'm again, trying not to step on toes too much, but I do think that we do have to be careful with synchronization and evaluate what of this is cultural and holiday, and keep that in cultural and holiday in a large sense, and still use those things for the sake of the gospel, but not meld those things and marry them to the gospel, if that makes sense. And I hope that does. So let's talk about the incarnation, because if you look at the Christian aspect of Christmas, you get to the doctrine of the incarnation. What do we mean by that? Well, doctrine is the result of, and I've said this on a number of episodes, but I want to make sure that this is clear, is the result of theology. What's theology? Theology is the study of God. The study of God results in certain things that we believe. Those things we call doctrine. So the doctrine of the incarnation is that God became man, that God dwelled among us, specifically in the person of Jesus Christ. And so the way that that works is you'll get these statements. Some people say Jesus was fully God and fully man. I think that's a little confusing. I try to say Jesus was truly God and truly man, so everything about him was truly God, but he also added to his deity or his godship, godness, humanity. And there are a number of things about that that are super, 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 another thousand supers after that important. One is that it shows us the nature of who God is. God, who created the universe, chose to come and dwell with us, and I think the way that he did that is really important. He wasn't born into a rich family. He wasn't a super important person as far as, you know, the political sphere would go. He chose to take the route of shame, being born into an unmarried couple, which was a huge no-no culturally at that time. Grew up not wealthy, was a political refugee, and then hung out with fishermen. So you get this idea that God didn't view himself as so far above us that he wouldn't come and actually dwell with us in a lowly state. And I think that that says something about the nature of who God is. That the God of the universe, who has the ability to create just with the words of his mouth, would come and dwell with us as a poor carpenter refugee who hangs out with fishermen. So I think that that says something to us at the end of the day as well about the fact that we're never too far gone for God to reach out to us. God is able to reach out to us because he's willing to be among the broken. He's willing to be among the poor. He's willing to be among those who are politically oppressed, and all of those sorts of things. There's another important aspect of the incarnation, and I'll try and develop this as best I can. If Jesus didn't become man, we're hooped. And maybe that's the best way to develop it. I don't know. The reason being is that as man, and this ties, this is talking very much the Bible and themes in the Bible. If you go all the way back to the book of Genesis, Adam, who is the first created man, sins. And so Jesus in the Bible is viewed as a second Adam, meaning that Jesus, as truly God and truly man, is able to atone or make up for that sin. On God's behalf, he's able to represent God, and on man's behalf, he's able to represent man. And so he becomes the perfect intercessor, the perfect intermediate. And in order to be that, he has to be truly God and truly man. And that, again, is good news for us, because if Jesus didn't become truly man, we can't have a restoration with God that restores and bridges our sin. And that's a super, super simple kind of conversation around that. But I do think it's important to recognize, when we're talking about all these things, the importance of the incarnation. One of my favorite things as well is, if you read the Gospels, you get what we call a genealogy. And I don't know if you've ever done one of those family trees. Probably you have, because I think that's like a mandatory thing to do in elementary school or maybe high school. When I did mine, I didn't get back very far, because our family history, we don't really know. If you go back, I think like three generations, that's kind of where it stops on my dad's side, because my grandparents came over from Germany and they just didn't really talk about what had happened. We kind of theorized that they were German Jews trying to escape Nazi Germany. there are a number of reasons for that, but we just don't know a ton. But if you look in the Bible, the Jews kept significant genealogies. And you get this genealogy in the beginning. I don't even remember which gospel it is, which is terrible. I think it's Matthew's, that or it might be Luke's. But anyways, you get this genealogy that talks about Jesus being the son of so-and-so. Jesus is the son of so-and-so. And within that genealogy, there are a number of names that are super kind of steeped in sketchiness. I don't know if that's the best way to put it, but Jews would have known the names of some of these people and been like, man, there's a Gentile in Jesus' lineage. There's this messed up person in Jesus' lineage. And what that says, I think, is that God brings salvation out of a messed up history. And so when you begin to look at that in a applicationary way, that's not a word at all, but we'll go with it. When you begin to look at that, what that says to me is that even in the midst of sordid history, God is sovereign to bring salvation. So even in the midst of things that I've messed up, even in the midst of my sin, even in the midst of my brokenness, God is very much so capable of bringing his salvation through Jesus. So that's a little bit of talk on the incarnation. And then the last thing that I'll talk about here is this. I think it's good for Christians to use the calendar to our advantage. And what I mean by that is people will do certain things at certain times of the year, and we need to find ways to leverage those things for the sake of making the gospel known. So I'll give you an example, which is Halloween. Now, growing up, Halloween for me was something we kind of didn't really touch because it was wicked. And I get the critique, I get all of that, but I think there's something very, important that a lot of Christians have missed, in that there's one day a year where people are going to bring their kids around to your house, knock on your door, and talk to you. So why would you not, as a Christian, take the opportunity to build some form of relationship with your neighbors through that and leverage that? I know there's one church up by where we used to live that they do a trunk or treat. They just give out candy out of the trunks of vehicles as you go by to kids. And whatever you think about Halloween, honestly, I don't really care. I think there's something to be said for using the calendar to engage our communities and engage the people around us. And I get, again, you have to be careful about the whole synchronization thing. But, man, some of these opportunities, I think, are too good to waste. And so when we come to Christmas, and again in Easter, there are two times of the year where people are really, really open to hearing about Jesus. And so why would we not use some of those things, some of those times, to leverage our ability to reach into our community, to reach into our families, and have conversations around some of these things that may point people to the gospel? I think we're actually not doing our job if we're not using whatever we can, short of sinning, to reach people for the gospel. And so those are some things to consider as you jump into the Christmas season and this kind of wildly Christian but cultural pagan commercialized time, is that, yeah, there's a tension. Yeah, we wrestle with it all. There's some interesting history there. But at the end of the day, let's use this time of year as something that we can leverage for the glory of God and pointing people to the gospel of Jesus Christ.